You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. We will never, ever run out of oil, says Deborah Gordon in this interesting podcast on the future of fossil fuels. Deborah Gordon is a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where her policy research focuses on oil, climate, and transportation issues in the United States, China, and globally. Ms. Gordon spoke at the Wednesday, March 13, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Unconventional Oil, Illuminating the Global Paradigm Shift to New Petroleum Fuels. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Grace Zisk.
It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Deborah Gordon. Deborah is a non-residential senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the Energy and Climate Program, where her policy research focuses on oil, climate, and transportation issues in the United States, Canada, and globally. Since 1996, she has been a policy consultant specializing in transportation, energy, and environmental policy for nonprofit, foundation, academic, public, and private sector clients. From 1996 to 2000, she founded and co-directed the Transportation and Environment Program at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And from 1989 to 96, she founded and then directed the Transportation Policy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Additionally, Gordon has worked at the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in 1988 and 89, under a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Gordon began her career as a chemical engineer with Chevron and worked there from 1982 to 87. Gordon has served on National Academy of Sciences committees and the Transportation Research Board Energy Committee, lectured widely and given keynote speeches, and she has been featured on radio, TV, and in print media. Her first book, Steering a New Course, offered a comprehensive overview of U.S. transportation, energy, and environmental policy. Her recent book, 2 Billion Cars with Daniel Sperling, provides a fact-based case and roadmap for navigating the biggest global environmental challenge of this century, cars and oil. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Deborah Gordon, and afterwards, of course, we'll have time for your questions. Debbie.
So am I on, or should I speak into the mic too? Okay. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Grace. When Grace called and asked me to speak, I don't do a lot in Charlottesville. We've lived here for about a decade, and my husband's at the university, so I am the one that ends up traveling for work, but it's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to just reach out, you know, where you live, closer to home. I tend to work on more global issues, but I think the people in Charlottesville are really, really bright, so it's a great place to talk about global issues. The world technologically has really changed in our lifetimes, collectively here. I mean, certainly we saw motorization, we saw computer technology, we saw the internet, we now are seeing 3D printing, you know, things that we never thought would come about. But what I'm going to talk about, I don't think anyone thought was going to change, and including me, and I've been working on oil for a very long time. Really, as long as I can remember, certainly reinforced in the 1970s, was the sense that oil's depletable, oil will run out, and there was a sense of peak oil. We've all heard about, you know, oil peaking and then declining. And what happened about 2-3 years ago shocked the world. It shocked the oil companies, and it's now just starting to surprise policymakers and the public, and that's what I'm going to talk about. That is the fact that we will never, ever run out of oil. It's not oil, though, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. It's everything that we now, because economically the prices are high enough and technologically we're adept enough that we can transform anything with hydrogen and carbon in it into liquid fuel. So we've crossed over this Rubicon where we will never run out of it. And interestingly, that changes the dynamics of everything we do and how we think about how we live and make choices and policies. When you live in a world of scarcity, you act one way. When you live in a world of plenty, you act very differently. And we're in a world of plenty. So this is confronting the complexity of oil. It was supposed to go one tube, so I won't ask the question. I was going to say, when you hear oil, what do you think? You think transportation, which is certainly true. But oil is really in everything. About 70% today is in transportation. The other third, 30%, is in everything else that we use, that we enjoy in our lives, from plastic bottles to baby diapers to paint to nail polish remover to pacemakers. Oil's in everything, and we can't really live without it. So when there was no substitute for oil, it was, you know, a cause to really think in conservation and very creative ways. Now that there's so much oil, the question then becomes, how are we going to actually prioritize which oils we use? So this is just to show you, even though gas, and we've heard a lot in the papers about the shale gas revolution, which is starting in North America. This is the fracked gas, which I can talk a little bit about too. But still, with all the growth in global gas, oil will remain the dominant energy force, you know, worldwide for the foreseeable future. There'll be more oil consumed than any other form of energy. So this is the beginning of, well, what's oil? You know, is oil what we thought it was? Well, the answer is no. It's not that pooled, liquid, black, you know, relatively viscous substance that we all got used to. That still exists, but that's depleting. Conventional oil, as we've known it, is actually peaking and is on the decline and will eventually go away. So what will replace it is this. This is basically hydrogen and carbon. This is really all methane. It's the simplest hydrocarbon. But it's just chemicals that are combined everywhere. And this is what oil is becoming. And there's actually more to the story than even this, but these are the simplest ones to think about. So we have the conventional. Let's see if I can make this laser work up here.
Can you hear me? So we have crude oil that we've gotten used to all these years, and then associated with that are natural gas liquids. This is the really light end, more the natural gas side of oil, and the condensates. This is interesting because these always used to be a pretty small part of what we went for, which was this. This is what moves us around. This is what goes into all the things that we need. What's happening in the tight oil that we're reading a lot about, the fracked oil, there's a lot more of this in it. So the product itself, or the input into everything we need, is actually changing. Along the way, from the last 20, 30 years, oil has been getting heavier. And when something gets heavier in a hydrocarbon world, it means it has more carbon in it. Not more hydrogen. Hydrogen's light. So oil had been getting heavier. And then this is where oil, we were starting to go to pretty heroic places for oil. This was the Macondo, the deep water horizon, you know, explosion that we had. This was ultra deep oil. And now where we're going is into tight shale rock. What's interesting about the shale is that it's where all of the oil that used to be pooled had leaked into over the course of time. And we found it here first. This is very much a North American industry, shale gas and shale oil, but it turns out it's everywhere in the globe. It's just starting here. So what we do and how we do it here matters because we're setting the stage. Oils were getting heavier and heavier. This is Venezuelan extra heavy oil that comes out of the ground in Venezuela, and we don't really know what will happen now with Hugo Chavez dying and what we're going to do with Venezuela, but we've been getting a lot more oil to the Gulf Coast from Venezuela. But as you can see, it's really starting to become not the same thing. These things are similar, but they're not the same. But then when you get down into this stuff, that's when it really starts to change. Bitumen is ancient oil. It's been in the ground so long that the bacteria have eaten away the liquid. And what remains is basically on its way to coal. So if you gave it another few million years, it would become coal. But we, again, are very heroic about what we can do technologically. So we can turn this into that. Kerogen, which is in the Rocky Mountains and also everywhere around the globe, is immature oil. This is oil that hasn't been in the ground the millions of years, or the rock that hasn't been in the ground the millions of years that it needs to turn into this stuff. But again, we could do some pretty heroic things, especially at these high prices. We can actually turn this into that. What's not on the list here, I would put it over here on the side, would be turning coal into liquid. We've been along that path for a long time. We can actually go beyond this into coal and turn it into liquid this. Or we could take natural gas, because there's a real boom in natural gas, we can turn gas into liquid. What's interesting is every time you make these transformations, it's not only economically very expensive, it's also very damaging socially. It's very damaging in terms of climate, it's very damaging in terms of its local environment. There are just a lot of issues. So as we've moved away from something that was as we wanted it in the ground and nature transformed it, that's what this is. This is nature's transformation. Now we're going into man-made transformation of all of this stuff into oil, and it changes everything. This is just another way of showing what I just said. So this is where we've been. This is what oil has been. This is in terms of how heavy it is. An API gravity is a measure of heavy. This is in terms of how it flows, viscosity. When something's viscous, it's really thick. And what's changing about oil, this has been spreading out for a while into the heavier oils, but what's really changing about oil is the edges. Oil's becoming things at the periphery that, or we can turn these hydrocarbons into oil at the periphery where we didn't used to be able to do it before. So these are the ultralight oils at Eagle Ford in Texas, in the Bakken, you read about these things. And then these are the extra heavies and the bitumens in Canada. You read a lot about the Keystone Pipeline. I could talk about that after. But what's interesting is that when you try to make this and this into this, again, we're talking about a brave new world of oil. And just another way of showing you the same thing, this puts it more in a carbon context. Again, with the very heavy oils have more carbon. They tend to be more climate unfriendly. The lighter and lighter the oil, the less damage it might do to the climate. But this is what's interesting here is, I'm trying not to hit my turn thing, but I do my laser. It just puts it into terms that we can all associate with, so you can see how different these things are. So the tar and the bitumen and the kerogen, they might be the consistency of window putty. And the ultralight oils, these are the fracked oils, they tend to be ultralight, they can be the consistency of nail polish remover. Nail polish remover being, if you leave it open, it stinks, it's volatile, it evaporates, it'll go away if you leave the cap off for too long. So when you imagine trying to make what moves our cars, what makes our plastic bottles, into the same things that we want, we're demanding the same stuff, but we're making it out of more and more different things. And this just gives you a sense of how different the building blocks are. So all of these raw oils have different factions of hydrocarbon in them. They're all kind of built up differently. The extra heavy oils, which is the outer ring, have a lot of what's in the darkest red here, which is bottom of the barrel. This is the residual. This is the stuff that it's hard to do anything with. It's the solid part of the oil. So as you could see, if you imagined a barrel of extra heavy and a barrel of ultra light, they're not even containing the same building blocks. They're totally different things that are embedded in them to begin with. The white is actually very light naphtha and things that approach natural gas. So if I had to be very simplistic about it, I would say the extra heavies are on their way to coal, they're more coal-like, and the ultralight oils are on their way to gas, natural gas. So that's like the field of oil and how it's differentiating. So that's good. So to turn those rings and those different rings, because we can remember we're getting very different things now to make the same stuff that we want, you need to start doing things that are very Rube Goldberg. And what's interesting about this field is it started to develop. The whole refining sector has been transforming in the US, and the US refines more oil than any other country in the world. The US is the world's refiner right now, and probably will remain so for quite a while, especially with all the oil we found. But about 5-10 years ago, before we found this ultralight oil that was trapped in rocks and had to be fractured and horizontally drilled out, the fracked oil we're reading a lot about, we didn't know that existed. So the world started to transform around these extra heavy oils because we thought that was the last oil on Earth. So every refinery in the U.S. has pretty much been upgraded to preferentially handle that outer ring of the extra heavy. And it's not designed to manage or to refine or to turn into the products we want that inner ring, which has very different building blocks to it. And that's where there comes a bit of a breakdown. And it's, I have to say, as a person that reads the paper but works in this area, I find it so frustrating because so much of the discussion on oil right now, and oil being something that's so vitally important geopolitically, economically, you know, it's important for everything that we do, but we have to be more responsible than ever before now that it's transforming. What's so frustrating is how simple you read about it. It's spoken about as if it's one thing, that oil still remains that top left corner, you know, black crude, and it's not. And even, you know, when you read about the XL pipeline, that it's oil in the pipeline, and it's not. There's not oil in the pipeline. What's going in the pipeline is the bitumen, and you saw for the far right part, bitumen isn't the same thing as oil. So it's hard to imagine navigating this world until there's better transparency in this world. And I think that often is one of my messages in the work that I do at Carnegie now. It's a lot about disclosing and uncovering and making more transparent the choices that we now have. Because again, we're in this world of plenty, and plenty is really great because you have the opportunity to make choice. But if you don't make good choices or you deny that you have choices, you can make some pretty bad mistakes. So this is the trying to lead you through, and I have some great images to give you a sense of how different these things are, but just to give you a sense of going from these very different inputs, because that everything that's changing is what they call upstream. It's all the inputs into the different oils are really heterogeneous. They have to be produced, explored and produced, then they have to be transported and refined and processed, and then ultimately they get to the gas pump, they go into products, they go into petrochemical feedstock, they become the things that the economy wants. What I think about all the time is that the world has aligned itself that oil became the valuable commodity because we thought it was short. So a lot was about making sure you had enough input, you had enough feedstock to do everything you wanted to do. What's really changing about this field now, if oil is plentiful, or hydrocarbons to make oil are plentiful, what's interesting is the really valuable thing in all of this equation isn't the oil. It's the product. It's all the stuff that you want from the oil. It's all of the heart valves and the gasoline and the diesel and the jet fuel. It's all of that that matters much more to our economy than the oil itself. So there's really a huge economic transformation that's coming along with oil. It's just not really clear how it's going to play out on a global scale because oil is a global commodity. So here are some pictures just to give you a sense. This is that first part of the supply chain. This is the exploring and the producing oils. These I would call conventional oil. This is what you're used to seeing, how you get oil out of the ground. This is how you frack oil out of the ground. Fracking is really interesting. Fracking has a very small footprint on the ground, as you can see. I mean, this is a fracking pad. And there's not a lot of oil in any given play. In fact, they actually, there's a real drop off very quickly. So how they frack, which is a lot like how I've been thinking about, I don't know if any of you ever traded up in your housing market, but house flipping. I lived in California for a while and everyone was into house flipping. So you buy a house that, you know, you would fix up and then you would sell it for more and then you would move and buy another house. And this is how people would actually survive in California. Fracking's a lot like that, where you produce in one space and then you deplete, and then you just move it down the line. And you keep on, you know, there's no geography where you can really stop fracking. You just keep on moving, finding trapped oil everywhere under the ground. So, you know, physically, there's really no limit to how much you could frack. So there's the fracking. This is like the Macondo, the deep sea, when you get out into the deep sea. And this comes out as oil, but of varying types of oil, but generally oil as we know it. But the ways you get it are pretty heroic, because this can be 5 miles under the ocean floor. I mean, we're talking very, very deep, difficult circumstances here. A real clash of cultures here, too, because you get a very cold ocean floor with pressure going down, right, because you have all the water above you, and you have a very hot, you know, resource base with the pressure going up. So you can understand why the horizon had an explosion. It's very difficult. I've heard it explained more harsh than the moon down there. This is Arctic drilling, yet another place to go heroically to get pretty conventional oil out, but in a very difficult way. So again, we're going to have choices. We're going to have choices between some of these that are depleting and some of these that are really now, you know, becoming much more prolific, and then some of these very difficult things where we thought we had to go, but we might not have to go. So what you do with this is then you have to move it around. You have to move it by pipeline, you have to move it by barge, you have to move it by tanker, global commodity, things move everywhere. And more of that, the light stuff of this stuff is moving on rail actually right now. It's very interesting. This is booming right now. Then you have to refine it. Everyone's probably been, you know, up the Jersey Turnpike and seen some of the refineries. So you have to refine it, and you know, difficult environment. I worked behind a refinery early on in my career for a gas company, and it was the least favorite part of my day driving through the refinery. I always felt like it's very hot, there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of sound, there's a lot of fire, there's a lot of, it just feels like it doesn't feel safe, let me just put it that way. But we've gotten pretty good about doing it, and we do it for the world. And then you make products. And the products that, this is really the heart of what I'm talking about here. What these oils make, which are taken out in some pretty unconventional ways, but they're still relatively conventional oil, they make the high value stuff. They make petrochemical feedstock, diesel and gasoline, and jet fuel. That's what most of the economy wants out of a barrel of oil. This is what the extra heavies make the industry turn to. These are the bitumens. They can either be mined out of the ground. I've been up to Alberta. It's eye-opening. They're mined out of the ground not that differently than coal is. It looks like you're taking coal out of the ground. And then you could also actually, this is even the scarier part, which is interesting. Only 20% of the resource is mineable. 80% of these oil sands up in Canada, and they're elsewhere in the world. They're also in Utah and Colorado and everywhere else. But right now they're coming out in Canada. This is, you actually frack with steam. So it's horizontal drilling. It's called steam-assisted gravity drainage. And you go down into the ground under the bitumens. They could be maybe, you know, 1,000 meters below. They get deep, and that's why you can't mine them. And then you have to inject hot steam into them to melt them out of the ground. So very different. This gets into the Kerrigan. You either have to take it out of the ground or you have to start heating it out of the ground as well. So you could see from thinking about the other image I just showed, these oils, right from the get-go, are not, you know, the oils that we've grown up with that we were used to. Then you move them around. Again, they have to move around. But what's interesting about them is you can't refine them. You cannot put these oils into a refinery. You have to actually strip the carbon out of them or inject hydrogen into them. You have to upgrade them. They need an extra step in order to make them into the things that we want out of them. Then you refine them. And then, unless you do some pretty heroic things to them, they tend to make a different slate of product. They tend to make the diesel and the gasoline, the jet fuel, bunker fuel, which is for marine vessels, and petroleum coke. Petroleum coke's an interesting one because no one really was thinking about it as a product, but as we started getting these heavier oils out of the ground in the last 10 years, we got so much petroleum coke coming out along with it, it's the bottom of the barrel, that product is now being shipped to Asia to replace coal combustion. So you're basically getting coal out of oil, which no one was really thinking about, and it's terrible for the climate. It's really one of the worst outcomes you could probably imagine, because no one really wants to take the coal out of the oil, this pet coke, but they want to get the products that we need out of the oil, and this just comes along with the equation. The other way you could do it is you could just bombard it with hydrogen, but that's also extremely energy intensive. So here's where we sit. We sit with a brave new world of oils, a lot of choices, more choices than I think industry really appreciates now, and I can say for a fact, having been in working with Congress now, way more choices than the policymakers are ready to really make themselves aware of, and very few of them have chemistry backgrounds, so it makes it a little challenging for them to get it. But there are a lot of knowledge gaps here. There's the makeup of oil, that's what I've been talking about in the supply chains. How many transformations go on here, and what are these changes? What are the specifics of these things? These were generalities I was telling you, but these processes are all very different from each other. And there are a lot of choices that industry is making right now on our behalf to make these products for the market. The geography of oil and the price of oil are also gaps. I'll show you a couple of quick map and a graph on that. What are the sound investments in oil? You know, that's a good question when you have choices again, because the sound investment from a private perspective is to maximize profit. But the sound investment from a public perspective is to have transparency, longevity, consistency. We don't want to, you know, tear things up and build things up and move people around and, you know, disrupt habitats unless it's really going to be something that has large benefit for a long period of time and it could just, it could work itself out and be amortized. So that's been a real big question for this whole industry. And then of course the social impacts of oils, and the two big ones that are often brought up are water and climate change. Those are two. There's a lot of local issues, but the water and the climate change, water, local, climate, global, there are going to be huge impacts here. So this is the, you know, $64,000 question. What's the price of oil? No one knows, and no one will know what the price of oil is going to be. But what this remarkable transformation of now moving from an oil world to a hydrocarbon world has done for us is, it's actually spread the uncertainty of what the future price of oil will be. And this is the Energy Information Administration's most recent forecast. And they say that the price of oil heading out, you know, we're talking the next 25 years, next generation, could be anywhere between about $70 a barrel or as high as almost $250 a barrel. And when you're operating in that world, and we know that that middle reference curve, if you look at the curve that came before, the real movement, it won't be smooth. We do know that there's going to be a lot of movement in this market. And that's very difficult. It's difficult for the economy. It's certainly difficult for people. And it's difficult for an investment environment. It's going to be a very challenging place to navigate. So we have a lot of choice and a lot of plenty, but we have a lot of uncertainty, which makes it very difficult. And I was just listening, I was on a call yesterday, and someone who's in politics for a very long time was saying, all Congress really cares about is the price of the pump. You know, that's where they take their flak, when the price of the pump fluctuates, when the price of the gas pump goes up. But this is so far removed from what then the price of the pump will be, that it's even more uncertainty when you translate the global price of oil to the price of the pump. This is the global geography of oils. We're talking about changing trade and trade and also product and security shifts. There's a lot of question right now about Saudi Arabia keeps asking, well, if you found all this oil in North America, what does it mean for us? What does it mean for our trade relationship? Are you going to turn your back on us? No, there's a lot of question about how this is all going to settle out, and is there so much oil out there that maybe those people that need it for their own economic benefit, because a lot of these countries, Russia, Venezuela, most of Latin America, all of Latin America, probably Mexico, these are social, oil has become a social commodity. This is how they balance their own social budgets. So this is a huge issue in terms of security for the globe. Where these oils are, where they move, where the product is then refined and transformed, and then where the product moves. So you can imagine ships crossing in the night with feedstock and with product. There's just going to be a lot more complexity. I sometimes liken it to a multi-dimensional game of chess. That's all, you know, think all the pieces are moving at the same time. For a product that's so fixed in our economy that no one can really afford to change. And so oil has become a substitute for itself. That was always the goal, was to find a substitute for oil. That's been this, we're running out of oil, peak oil, we're not going to have enough oil, we need substitutes. Well, the reality is how it worked, the market worked. Oil became a substitute, or hydrocarbons became a substitute for oil. So really, oil became a substitute for itself. It's just a lot of different equations now. And this is just to talk about the infrastructure, you know, how these investments have to get made. They're huge. They're huge. They're expensive. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars globally will go into this new world of oil. But where it goes and where it's placed and where it trades and how it connects is really important. It's vital to having it be at least a little bit more secure. So we have pipeline debates. We have refining debates. There are a lot of debates that are going on right now. And then just to close, I thought that this was fascinating. Well, plenty of time for questions. This is from, I'm trying to remember the title of his book, Private Empire. If you've not picked up the book Private Empire, Steve Cole just wrote a book about the history of ExxonMobil. It's fascinating. He writes for Newsweek and he writes for The New Yorker. He's a great writer. He was at the Post for a long time. Phenomenal writer. Private empire. And his daughter did some research for him, and he came to an event that I did recently, and he was the lunchtime keynote, and I was asking him about this. I noticed like a sentence in the book, and I said, I need to find out more about this sentence because it just really intrigued me. And he said, oh, my daughter found that. And so I went online after, you know, and I found the actual ad from 1962. So this is an advertisement. I don't even know where it ran and which magazine it was in. But this was an ad from 1962 where Humble Oil said, which was, might have been a predecessor of Esso, but Humble Oil said, there is enough energy in the Arctic to melt all the glaciers in 1962, which I find so fascinating because it turns out that that's exactly what we're doing with climate change. We're not using the energy to directly heat up the glaciers, but indirectly. I mean, this is so predictable, so knowable. And so as we head forward here, I guess my question that I ask myself all the time in my work is, knowing what we know now and not counting costs that are sunk, how are we going to navigate this differently? How are we going to make this work? Because we will eventually destroy ourselves. You know, it's just there is no end. We can't count on geology to cut this, you know, cut our habit. It's not going to happen that way. So the question then comes, how then are we going to govern ourselves to do this? And we could talk about that in Q&A because I do work, you know, mostly on policy. But I wanted to give you the broadest background on something that you might have been reading about it a little bit with the Keystone XL pipeline stories or what's going on with the shale gas and all the debates going on. But the reality is I'm finding that most people have been focusing more on this pie so that there's this awareness out there that oil has gone from a pie that we thought was very small to now a pie that we think or know is much bigger. But what gets lost in translation, I'm finding, is that there's not as much awareness that there are way more slices on the pie than there ever were before. And that's where the choice comes. So it's not just the story that there's more of it, it's that there's more stuff that's really different from oil and really different from each other. And that's what we're going to have to learn how to navigate, really almost, you know, ex post facto, because we're using it so quickly. That and it's being the investments are happening so rapidly that it's very difficult to slow down and do this wisely, but we're going to have to make that work. So with that, thank you.
Thank you so very much, Debbie. You have made a difficult subject well, not exactly totally easy, but I know I have some questions, and I'm sure many of our members do. So please make sure you raise your hand, and I'll call on you, but don't talk until we get a microphone to you.
So lots to talk about. I take it that at about $100 a barrel, that it's cost that people can make money on these non-conventional oil things, right?
Yes.
So therefore, the barrier for politicians who might want to actually do something about public policy, essentially there is no barrier anymore because the economy has figured out it can operate at $100 a barrel, right?
Yep, that's what happened.
Now, so my question is, since you can unlock all possible forms of carbon under the surface of the earth, if you combusted it all, you know, roughly, mm-hmm. How much would you heat up the atmosphere? I mean, you can do it. You know what the inventory is. And
Yeah. We're so beyond 2 degrees. We're beyond 4 degrees. We're probably into 6 degrees. Yeah. And I don't know what will happen with coal. So the gas equation, actually, if we manage methane well, which is another very big question, because that's a greenhouse gas as well, and it's so small and so difficult. Having worked in the oil and gas industry, I can say it's very difficult and challenging to contain something that small. But if, assuming we can, and we could truly back out coal, and we could back out some of the heaviest, most energy-intensive oils, then you can move it back, and then, of course, conserve and use more fuel-efficient cars and et cetera. You can imagine containing that, but if it's really no holds bar, and it doesn't really matter which ones you take, and you take the worst ones first. So I have struggled sometimes with the conservation first or conservation only tack that we were following when we thought oil was running out. It was all about energy efficiency, and now we're going to get more fuel efficient cars on the road. This is, the Obama administration did two rounds of fuel economy standards, which is fantastic. So we'll finally be driving cars by 2025 that are like 50 miles per gallon, which will be great. But if you're taking the most carbon intensive oils out of the ground, even if you're using them more efficiently, you're like moving so fast to stand still. So we have to prioritize oil and sip oil. You know, you have to do two things now, and it's very hard for the politic to do two things well, as we've seen. It's hard to do one thing well, too.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. I was wondering, you said oil forever. Infinity is a long time. And how does that work with beginning in harmony with thermodynamics and the second law of entropy? It seems to be a great major contradiction here between profit and the rate at which we're degrading what I call the mesocosm, mm-hmm. between the micro and the macrocosm. And that, we live in the mesocosm. And you're seem to be talking about what is in the microcosm, but it doesn't relate it to the macrocosm, which involves thermodynamics and the second law of entropy.
I don't think we're going to hit up against any natural limits in our lifetimes. I don't think we'll hit up against any natural limits in the lifetimes of the politics or the investments or, you know, of our, you know, of you know.
Me or my grandchildren?
Both. I don't think we're going to hit up against any limits because we're just that good at technology. I mean, I guess that's where I started off. I think that there's no real limit to what we can do technologically if the prices are right. And this is a product that is so valued that the prices go up when there's not enough readily available in this form. So you can then, I don't know if you all read, I think it was in the paper yesterday, this has been on the radar for a very long time, but there's an endless supply. I know it's not good to say endless, but there's basically an endless supply of frozen methane in the oceans, of these methane hydrates. And Japan yesterday just announced that it's been very concerned since Fukushima. It's been very concerned what to do. You know, does it go back into nuclear? And it doesn't really have a lot of the natural gas, and so it's always going to be an importer. It was always an importer. So they actually, yesterday, they announced it. I don't know when they did it, but they actually are successfully producing these. Now, they're not as deep in Japan. The ocean's not deep as deep right there as they can get. Some of these are very, very deep and very difficult to get. But they're producing methane from the seabed floor.
1798, in which he predicted that the population explosion will far exceed the peak of food, the peak of oil, the peak of coal, and the peak of gas.
Water.
A peak of water, too.
Yeah, I think that this is just my, you know, my opinion. I think that I would be more concerned about water in a peak situation, in a shortage situation. I'd be more concerned about global food and global water at this point, and not about energy resources. Oil, coal, and gas seem to be so plentiful at this point, again, because we're so good at being able to make any combinations of them deal with things that are very sour, which means it has a lot of sulfur, make it when it's very deep. We've gotten better and better. And part of that was the market worked. I mean, we pushed out the technology possibility frontier curve on oil when the prices went up. And as Bob said, we all thought the world as we knew it, starting with Saudi Arabia, the world as we knew it would end. Like civilization would somehow combust, or people wouldn't be able to live in harmony if we crossed over. It used to be $30 a barrel of oil. Then it went up to about $60 a barrel of oil. Then it was $70 a barrel of oil. Now we've sustained $90, $100 a barrel of oil, and we're all here. So if there's no economic limit, there's no technological limit to this. Even some of the main principles, I think, won't hit up against it in any near term.
Recently, the Wall Street Journal published a graph that showed that the global temperature is spiking
at an absolutely alarming rate in comparison to global temperatures over the last 11,000 years. Mm-hmm. Combusting oil products, coal products, any of these fossil fuels is going to be an extremely damaging event. There are two questions I have. How can the costs of that damage be factored into the costs of production so that the producers pay the penalty that they're imposing on everyone else? And how can we move investment dollars away from fossil fuel combustion and toward sustainable, truly sustainable energy practices?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great question. I mean, in a market, if you don't price is the best form of information in a market. That's what tells us and the industry what to do. And if you don't price something, you basically are saying that this is not important. It's not valued in the market. So until and unless there's a price on carbon, we're not going to value carbon. None of us like that message because we don't want to impose taxes on ourselves. It's just not the American way. But there's been a lot of talk about transforming and moving taxes on things we want more of, like labor, you know, and profit, and then moving the taxes over to carbon, which we want less of. Because you tend to want to tax things you want less of because taxes actually, you know, they decrease demand a little bit, which is a good sidebar of taxes. So if we could get rid of, say, the payroll tax and impose an economy-wide carbon tax, that would be huge. It would be a huge transformation in our society. It's just changing again. You know, we do policy in very iterative, small steps. And that's, I think, been the holdup with considering carbon tax. I believe the time of carbon tax will come because of the budget deficit. So there will come a time where we're going to need more money, and we're going to get smart about raising money here, but then either rebating some of the proceeds back or eliminating taxes on other things that will all, you know, remove the harm from people. So I think that that's going to be a very big part. And then your second part of your question was about alternatives and renewables and how we move into the sphere, and I think that they're tied together, because if you don't price, if there's no externality tax on the production of carbon, now, even at these prices, here's the issue, at these prices of oil, say $100, $200 a barrel, it used to be, the old paradigm was, at those prices, all these alternatives became economic. But when oil is economic and gas are economic, you know, more types of hydrocarbons are economic, if you're the producer, are you going to start producing what you know and what your infrastructure is all geared up for? Or are you going to step over and say, you know, I'm going to go do solar if you're Shell? Are you going to do solar or are you going to do oil? Well, I wrote an article a couple years ago that basically said the oil companies do oil best. I mean, that's what they do. That's why they do it. These are really big capital-intensive infrastructure projects. But very interestingly, I should raise this because it's an interesting wrinkle on this whole thing. The fracked oil, the oil that we're reading so much about that's starting in North America first, that has not been compatible with the oil industry. That's not oil industry oil coming out of the ground. That's independent oil company Wildcat oil. That oil, because you saw that little derrick that I showed you and I said you have to keep moving it, that's not billions of dollars of infrastructure that's fixed. And that's what the Chevrons and the Exxons and the Totals do well. So they don't do fracked oil well yet. The problem is now they know that it's the game, so they're going to figure out a way to do it and make it worth their while doing it. But this whole transformation in oil, North American oil, through the Bakken and Eagle Ford and all this light tight oil, shale oil, that did not come through the oil industry. That's why they were shocked. It wasn't oil that they were producing. This is oil that, you know, kind of the riskier part of the business, the self-made. It was really almost like the business was in the turn of the last century. This was like spindle top all over again. It wasn't the current industry. There's also a debate whether the fracked oil technology in North America that's booming here and can boom in Canada as well, because it crosses right over the border into Saskatchewan and Manitoba, whether that actually will translate and how long it will take to translate globally. So even though there's this oil everywhere in the globe, this fracked oil, the tight oil, It's really a very private land, risk-taking, different type of business. It's not, as just as it's not well-suited to the Shells of the world, it's not extremely well-suited to the Rushes of the world. You know, to the you know, kind of wasteful, capital-intensive, state-run oil industries. So we kind of, in America, have a 10 or a 15-year lead on the rest of the world in terms of this light tight oil. The question is, can we learn how to do this right and export the right way to do it? And just the last thing I'll answer on this question, because I think about this as a solution too. So it's not that we have to give up oil altogether, and I don't think it's realistic for us to say that we ever will, because I just don't think it will ever happen. It's in too much of what we need and do. But there are parts of oil that we need to start not burning. We can't burn the pet coke. We have to think about activating that carbon, locking it down, and not combusting it. We don't need to combust it. We don't need it. We've got plenty of natural gas. There's no reason to burn something that's dirtier than coal. So we need to think about other ways. I know industry wants to make money on every drop, but it's not. That solid stuff needs to somehow be reconfigured to something else. And then the petrochemical feedstock that comes out of this ultra-light tight oil that we're finding in North America, that's not combusted. So if we can figure out a way, and we're thinking about it now, if we can think of a way to do petrochemicals, have a resurgence in chemicals manufacturing in the U.S. and do it right, which is going to be huge water protection. They're just redoing the Clean Water Act right now. I mean, chemicals are a huge issue for water. They always leak. They always contaminate. We need to really think about the 21st century way of doing chemicals. But if we don't burn much of that ultralight and we use it to manufacture chemicals, that's not a high carbon path. So if we can lock out the pet coke and really do petrochemicals safely, then you've grown economies, well, especially with the petrochemicals, without carbon, which is going to be a part of what we have to figure out. How do we keep growing and thriving, but not combusting and, you know, stewing in our own carbon?
I truly appreciate it. As part of an organization called 350.org, which I'm sure you know of, we are locally trying to get people to pay attention to this, and you know, we'd like to know what we can do for policymakers. Now, when you look at, you were mentioning the fact that the oil companies are not into these alternate things. They're not energy companies, true, because like BP just last week decided they're out of the solar business because there's just not enough profit in it. And when I look at the carbon tax and I think about what's going on in Australia right now, their prime minister is about to turn, they're about to turn over to a new prime minister as a result of putting a carbon tax out there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how we can do this. I mean,
yeah, it's going to be a challenge, but I think a lot like the price of oil getting higher, I think there's life on the other side of a carbon tax. I just think that it's scary to people. I mean, especially, you know, capitalist societies tend not to tax themselves. I just think we're going to probably go there because of our deficit. We're going to go there because we were forced to go there. And you know what? I think we're going to survive. And ultimately, if we're really lucky, we'll turn on whole new technologies that are low carbon because of it, and we'll thrive. And that's when we'll see renewables take off. You know, when you say not putting out carbon actually levels the playing field, that's when you end up with being able to turn on all of these new technologies. But it's not going to be easy.
Given an industry that is willing to blow off the top of mountains, what comfort can the average person take in the fact that they won't do this fracking in the worst possible way and cause the greatest harm?
Yeah. I kind of come from the camp. Now, to full disclosure here, my first job at Chevron was working for them doing environmental work. So I actually wore the hat that tried to do their business with a smaller footprint. You know, that was my many years working there and then designing gas and oil plants after that. But I think that we're going to have to make mistakes. I don't think that, I've been thinking about this a lot today. It had to do with a project I was just working on. And it's going to be very hard to avoid pitfalls here before they happen. I just think that the more people's eyes are wide open, I think that this industry is capable of actually doing this well. Will they do it well without regulation, without pricing, without oversight? Probably not, because like any industry, their number one is their bottom line. And anything that you do to change that, you know, to protect will cut into the bottom line. But they can be forced to do it safely. And I believe that, especially with the gas fracking, I think we will learn how to do it safely. I'm more concerned with the lack of transparency in all of this. That I think that bothers me the most. I feel that if you want to build a new industry here that is about something that endures, that is worth the money you're going to put into it and worth the disruption that's going to come from it and worth then the value that you're going to get from it that lasts, has lasting value, that if you don't start with transparency, if you're not telling what's in the frac fluid, if you're not talking about what your processes are, to my mind, that's already like you're designing to fail. I'm hoping that the industry will come through a transformation here to realize we're not fighting for every dollar because we're a volume business. You know, there's a lot of this stuff out there and there's a lot of demand for it. So maybe they can take, you know, less money in per unit profit, but they're going to still make a whole lot of money. But the best way to do that is with full disclosure. And I'd like to see a lot more full disclosure in this business.
Considering the fact that there is this glut of hydrocarbons that's been discovered over the last two decades or whatever, do you think there's any reason that the American people need to continue to subsidize through stipends and tax breaks the oil industries in the foreseeable and distant future?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. I mean, the fracked oil, those subsidies weren't helping the fracked oil. They were, you know, again, independent oil producers. I don't know that we would have found the fracked oil without some level of subsidization for that part of the industry. But the major oil industry, the big oil companies, big oil, I don't think that they are probably in the game anymore to need subsidies. And the subsidies aren't that big, but they do stand for something. You know, it would be healthier to just zero them out. We're not talking a lot of money anymore that's being there, but there are tax breaks and, you know, depreciation allowances. There are things that are just, in a society where we have such a big, you know, deficit, it doesn't make sense to be giving a break to an industry that's actually quite healthy. So I would say that there's a lot of talk in Washington about just, you know, cutting it out and just saying, you know, you know what your mission is. You know, you have to figure out where it makes most sense to do it.
Keystone. It seems to me that a vote for Keystone is like voting for yourself and hurting the rest of the world, like the congressman who votes for it. It's good for his constituents, even though it's not good for the country. But on the other hand, if we don't vote for Keystone, it's going to get shipped to China. It's going to be produced anyway. Is there any chance that if we turn down Keystone, that it's a message loud enough that we have to do something and maybe this stuff should not be produced?
I think there's a lot of confusion on Keystone. I was just starting to write one of those five myths. Think about, maybe it will be in the paper if I ever get it out. But there's a lot of confusion on Keystone now. And I think if we knew then, 5, 7, 10 years ago, what went up in Alberta with all of this growth around the oil sands, if we knew then what we know now about tight oil in the United States, I don't think we'd even be having this conversation about Keystone. I don't think it would ever have happened. I don't think we would be developing those resources first. So there was a bit of a mistake of timing, you know, just an accident of timing that had this come. So then the question for Keystone is, if that is the case, if people can look back and say, would we do that now knowing that we have all this light tight oil in the States? And if the answer is no, well, sunk costs shouldn't count. They really shouldn't. I mean, I know it matters to the industry, but it doesn't matter to society. If you're making a mistake, then it makes sense to correct that before you actually go to the full lengths. The other question, so that is one question, is this still a viable, necessary investment? And I think the jury, in my mind, is out on that. The other thing is the assumption that we'll go to China. Will it? I'm not so sure it will go to China. It's quite landlocked and very difficult. The pipeline going west will probably never get built. And honestly, if we don't build the pipeline, and we haven't, and to be fair, it's not building the pipeline. This has been a mistake in the press. This is about expanding an existing pipeline, and rerouting it. So there is a pipeline out of Alberta called the Keystone Pipeline. It's currently running. It's just not running at volumes that Canada would like it to run at over the next 25, 35, 40 years. Can America make a pledge to Canada, knowing about the light tight oil that we have, for 40 years of purchasing? I'm not even sure that we want to commit to Alberta to grow out around this even more than they already have, to say, we pledge to you, America will be, you know, we will buy your oil first, you know, for two generations to come. I don't even know if we can say that fairly to Canada at this point, so I worry a little bit about the promises that we're setting up with Canada, because when you're up there, you see what you see in most boom towns is people building their lives on this being the case until they're our age. Like, this will never change. And there's a lot of disruption that happens from changing that equation, especially between neighbors. So I think that there are a lot of factors with Keystone. And then the last thing, and I showed it up here, is the rail. So Keystone has not been expanded. It's been held up by the Obama administration, although the southern leg of it from Oklahoma south was built. So the expansion and the rerouting hasn't yet happened for the northern from Oklahoma up to Alberta. That's what's being held up. But the oil's still coming out. It's just going in rail. And you know what? The industry prefers it. It costs a little bit more, maybe, but it's really flexible. It's not fixed. And you can keep adding rail cars, so there's like no end in sight. So it's interesting, it's not really, I think that the argument's become bigger than itself. It's like morphed into like this whole question that we have with ourselves of friendliness across borders and what oil means to us, and are we gonna be, you know, are we afraid of our legacy of using oil? It's become so polarized, and I feel like we've totally missed the real discussion here. I'd love to see it.
My question kind of maybe goes on the tail end of this man talking about removal of the mountaintops or whatever. And I'm hearing industry, and I'm hearing consumers and their products. And I'm thinking back on the end result of the railroad going across the country and the lives that were killed, and people were tremendously hurt by the outcome of providing all of us that exist today with a rail system and an easy access. And what I am thinking about is industry versus, or us need to have our products that we're used to, and not thinking about the people who are being impacted by the technology that isn't quite there yet, that needs to go there to have the dollars that are going to produce into the industry to create the technology so that we are all feeling very comfortable with our gasoline in our cars and our oil products or whatever. And you touched on it very slightly by saying the social impact. This is the human and environmental Earth impact. Please address that.
Yeah. And it's way bigger than the U.S. You know, we sit here in Charlottesville, but this is clearly a global phenomenon. We are tied together by oil and product. And we're all in it together, as other parts of the world are even clawing up that, you know, that whole mountain of advancement and motorization and, you know, having certain lifestyles. There's a lot of this going on globally, so it's certainly not just at home. It's going to be really hard to take a little bit of a respite. I was really, actually, bizarrely, happy for my issue about the economic downturn, because I felt the economic downturn gave us a chance to breathe. Like, okay, we're not moving as much. You know, vehicle miles travel have gone down in the last few years. Gasoline sales have been going down in the U.S. It's not clear if this is because of an institutional change or it's just been an economic, you know, outcome of having a downed economy. But the economy actually bought us a little bit of time. I wish we had made more of that time, you know, because it globally now had spread. China was red hot, and then China actually cooled off. So we're in a bit of a lull right now to figure out how we want to readjust this. And the best way to do it is through pricing, but it's not a very comfortable way because you're going to have to consume less or consume differently when prices are higher. You know, that's, again, economies work with pricing. The human toll of all of this is huge. The human benefits of all of this are huge. So it's very hard to, like, we all wouldn't be here today without gasoline. So it's a very thorny problem. There's interesting, and maybe a good way to answer this is I just wrote a piece with a colleague of mine on the collision of two megatrends. I'll leave you with a, oh, I think I have it here. So you guys have it. No, I mean, I have my my website, so you can look. Because the things that I've been writing are all on here. So you can look at that, all, where it's like a kind of a virtual library of everything we've been doing on unconventional oil. There are two megatrends going on globally. One is unconventional oil. There are a lot of megatrends, but the two that I've been thinking about are unconventional oil. That's what I've been talking about. And then my colleague works on urbanization. And when you think about global urbanization, the world is growing and the world is urbanizing at the same time, especially Asia. Well, in cities, you don't really want a car. So urbanization, if done right, could actually help us back out of oil. But with a lot of oil, and if oil gets cheap, the lower part of that curve, it could actually help us do urbanization wrong. And we could be motorized, kind of strangling ourselves like Beijing does, with a lot of cars and unfavorable, you know, atmospherics, and then you're choking on your own exhaust. So these two megatrends, if they're aligned, urbanization and unconventional oil, could actually be very powerful globally. And they could help us, hopefully, live better lives or you know, keep the lives that we enjoy, access to things that we want. You know, a really interesting thing is to always remember, no one really wants oil. No one really even wants cars. What we want is, those are derived demands. What we really want is mobility, access, you know. We want things that are much more basic than that. So it's thinking about how we can get some of that with maybe, you know, less of these inputs. And urbanization is a good way to maybe navigate that.
I'm hearing from you that there is no end to oil. It's a universal blessing. We are so fortunate in the fact that we're never going to run out. Where do you stand on the amount of CO2 in our atmosphere and how it will affect our human civilization?
So I don't mean to give the impression that I think that this is a godsend, all this oil, but I think that as I go around and I've been talking about this, it's more of like the battle cry for people to get shocked out of the oil's going to run out, there's a natural peak, and we'll be saved from ourselves. So that's how I positioned it more. I'm very concerned about CO2. I think CO2 is huge. And if you really want to know what I think, which I'm not so sure I even like to say this out loud. I find myself saying it more and more out loud, and I'm getting more and more nervous about saying it. So I think if we keep going this route of combustible economies and the way that we've done it and there's no limit in sight, I think that there's going to be a really difficult role and a really difficult way that we're going to have to geoengineer. We're gonna end ourselves where we started, which is we're gonna have big oil giving us this stuff, probably too cheaply and too easily, and using it maybe a little bit too, you know, liberally. And then we're gonna use big oil, and others are gonna have to bust the carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, it's really another engineering equation. So I think the way we're headed, if we're not careful, is a very interesting, dangerous, I mean, talk about a world without borders and peace issues. I think of this from a Carnegie's perspective. You know, geoengineering is really a brave new world of how you actually are friends with your neighbors and live on the globe together. Because when you start putting things in the ocean and up in the atmosphere, you really messed with a lot of things that aren't yours. And, you know, they're not your toys. And this is going to get very complicated very quickly. But I think that that's the way this whole engineered society is heading. I mean, we basically went from thinking there was a limit to oil, both economically and technologically, and geologically, a limit to oil, to realizing that we could push boundaries and the market worked and we can expand and find all of this oil and there is no natural limit, and we're not really good at, you know, moderating ourselves, then we're basically begging for some sort of engineering solution to this whole problem. And I think that's just going to be another new brave world of, you know, I don't know if I want to be on the earth when that happens, quite honestly, but I think that that's the way that, you know, if you think technologically, that's the way things happen.
Thank you very much. I did read your posting or your full article online before coming here. I knew I couldn't make it on time. I see it has a date of 2011. Perhaps the work was done in 2010. I don't know. But a lot of your concern seems to be wrapped around carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of what's the record of the past 17 years now going on, confirmed the temperature record globally, has not risen significantly, hasn't risen for over 17 years. Carbon dioxide has increased 10% in the atmosphere. There is no dire linkage, and using such inflammatory and worrisome language about fighting over geoengineering, as an engineer I would say, how would you know how to geoengineer the climate when 20 or 22 climate models are used by the IPCC cannot accurately predict? They don't know enough to model correctly. So, you know, you're really looking for problems. A pie in the sky idea, but there is no science behind it that anybody wants to set behind it. The final question is, you alluded to, who gets to set the thermostat and for where, assuming you could do it?
He ended up turning himself around, just wrote a book advising presidents, actually, saying this theory is very solid. I mean, the big question to me isn't that the carbon is rising. I think that just a little bit of chemistry, and you know that when you combust hydrocarbons, you get CO2, and when you combust more, you get more. I think the big question comes down to what you do about it, and that's where a lot of this is broken down to my mind. But I will admit the climate's a very complicated place. So there's, and here's an interesting fact of the climate. So there are short-term climate forcers and there are long-term climate forcers. The long-term climate forcers, the CO2 is the longest, thousands of years. Once you create CO2, you just, you know, it's going to be in the atmosphere for thousands of years, and unless you geoengineer it out somehow, it's there. It's that stable. There are a lot of short-term climate forcers. There are things that push the temperature in time periods before they destroy themselves that are more like 20-year time frame. One of the climate forcers that actually cools is sulfates. So when we have volcanic eruptions, or we put out a lot of sulfur. Now, sulfur kills you. You don't want to do this, but this is just, you know, a lot. You don't want to breathe sulfates, but because, say, China uses a very high sulfur base in their fuel, their diesel is high sulfur diesel, they put out a lot of cooling agents, and it masks the warming that naturally goes on with the long-term climate forcers in the climate. So climate is obviously very, very complicated, but I guess there are camps. My sense is that the bigger camp right now, and it doesn't make it right, but the bigger camp believes climate change is, that the global temperature is rising, but there still is, well, there's a small, but I think, I've been working on this for a long time, that it seems to be a very small group that still maintains that this isn't happening. I think that the overwhelming number of scientists, and maybe you're not one of them, the overwhelming number of scientists really believe that this is an enduring problem for us to deal with.
My uncle ran a pump station for the Tidewater Oil Company in the early parts of the 20th century, and they used oil from the pipeline to run the diesel engines that ran the pumps. Now, I'm not sure if that figured into any accountant's equation, but I assume that as long as they could sell enough oil to carry the capital cost of the pump station and the operating costs, that they were okay. But now I'm thinking about the XL pipeline, and if you have the oils up there in Canada as being high viscosity oils, you're going to have a lot of friction losses in the pipe coming down. And whereas if you send it by rail, you can get 450 miles per ton on a gallon of diesel oil. So what is the relative loss. I mean, and with rail, you just have rolling friction, not friction in the pipeline. So what's the relative cost of sending oil by pipeline, and especially viscous oil, versus just putting it in a tank car?
Well, thank you for asking that question, because it's something I didn't mention earlier. So this is really interesting. So Canada has, up until this moment in time, I showed you the upgrading, the extra step that you have to put on the heaviest oils in order to then refine them into product. Canada's been doing all of that upgrading up in Alberta, which is why the petroleum coke's been stockpiling up there, and they're truly landlocked. Canada doesn't want to do upgrading in Canada. It doesn't make sense to have a lot of this product that has low value, degraded product, be stuck in the middle of nowhere where it costs you more to send it than it's worth. So what they want to put it, so up until this point in time, in the existing Keystone pipeline and other pipelines, is coming old conventional Canadian West Canada Select oil and upgraded bitumen called Syncrude, synthetic crude. This synthetic crude is not viscous because it's all been upgraded up there, and all that heavy stuff, all the asphaltenes that would have made it really viscous, all of that has been stripped out up there. The new pipeline has a totally different design on it, and no one's really talking about it in the media. Canada's not going to upgrade there. We're expanding the Panama Canal. We're expanding everything along the Gulf Coast. We are going to become the world's exporter of these heavy products like petcoke and bunker fuel. So everything wants to come down economically to the Gulf Coast. So what they're going to do is, I have to just roll my eyes when I say this, they are now moving to take all the light, tight oil that we are finding in North Dakota, not turning that into gasoline and petrochemical feedstock largely, a little bit, not much. They're going to reverse it on a different pipeline and send it up to Canada to dilute the bitumen, mix it. So you're mixing window putty and nail polish remover. You didn't make a new oil. It might look like oil, it might act like oil, it might flow like oil. It's window putty and nail polish remover mixed together. And so that dill bit, the diluent and the bitumen, that dill bit is going to come into the pipeline. So what's really happening with the expansion of this pipeline is that no one's asking the question, what's in the pipeline? What are the conditions for the pipeline? It's all about yes or no, build the pipeline. And no one's saying, as you know, the U.S., what benefits us to be in this pipeline? And do we want all of our light, tight oil going to Canada to make it more favorable to send all of their really heavy oil down here? So there are these types of, you know, decisions that are kind of happening for us de facto. And that's a lot of what we need to, that's the transparency angle. We need to know. So there was a lawsuit in Texas. I don't know if you read about this. There was a lawsuit in Texas with the pipeline that was just built, the other part of the Keystone. And a landowner who's not against oil at all, a landowner said, I agreed, I sold you, you know, my rights to build the Keystone pipeline here with oil in it. And he said, I don't want your pipeline because your pipeline doesn't have oil in it. It has dill bit in it. That's not oil. And it went to the courts. So we had some sort of struggle with what's in the pipeline. You know, it's not oil. And those are the questions, you know. The problem that we're having is the products aren't going to change anytime soon. We're still going to have gasoline for the foreseeable future. We're still going to have diesel. I think things will change. If oil's changed enough, product ultimately will change. But the foreseeable future, we're going to have the products that we expect out of oil. So it's very hard for the public looking at a gas pump and not seeing anything different to be able to really appreciate the fact that the oil isn't oil. And that's, I think, really confusing for people.
The longer I wait, the more I think of to ask a question and then a point. Why not just abandon the pipeline and stick with rail 100%?
It's a good question. I mean, it's not the same owners. You're going to have a lot different winners and different losers. It's not easy for investors to just walk away from things. And they've built the southern part of the pipeline. I don't know. I met with someone recently who does industry prognostications. You know, they're thinking kind of for, they get a lot of information and they think, and he said to me, this was already about a month ago, so it might have changed. He said, my you know, diagnostics on the pipeline were 35% it wouldn't get built, 65% it would. And then that had been. And then when I met with him a month ago, he said, I flipped. And this is a really smart guy that does this for a living. And he said, 65% it won't get built and 35% it will. I said, really? Really? I mean, I think that we're still in a bit of a limbo and we have a new Secretary of State. I don't know. My bigger question is, if it gets built or doesn't get built, what are the conditions under which it operates? I think that's so much more important than the building of a pipeline or the building of any infrastructure. It's the permit conditions. So that's where I hope that we quickly, but no one wants to have that conversation because the battle is still raging on yes or no on the building of it. But I've been trying to push people into the, you know, we better start talking about how we're going to operate it, what's going to go in it. I mean, I would love to see Canada be responsible for the carbon. It should go into their carbon equation. If they're going to ship all the carbon to us and not upgrade it up there, then they should take responsibility. You know, there's no real Kyoto global agreement any longer, but in terms of reporting your carbon emissions and saying that you're living within your reductions that you pledged, I think Canada should take responsibility for the carbon that they're putting in the pipeline because it's going to be ours to deal with, but we didn't create it.
I was listening to NPR just before I drove over here, and they were interviewing, Terry Gross was interviewing a Pakistani man who now lives in Lahore. And when he was born 40 years ago, Lahore had 1 million people. It now has 10 million. Mm-hmm. And this is the way of the world. I think he says we're headed toward 90% urbanization. So here, I have a trivia question for you. What city in America has the lowest carbon footprint?
Is it a big city or a small city?
It's a major city.
Major
city. You know, it's not a...
New York?
You know, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's something that we're looking into at Carnegie. So urbanization is probably good for agglomeration benefits, and you want to know where the tipping point is. It maybe goes to a little bit of the question earlier, that you have certain systems start to break down. So you want to make sure that as you urbanize, you remain on that lower consumption, you know, make the agglomeration benefits really count.
So, fantastic talk and good discussion. But thinking about public policy, if you take the scientific uncertainty about what happens if, for example, you double CO2, because it's a complex problem, climate, as you said, and now you marry that with god-awfully complicated social issues like the economists deal with, and you try to estimate how much you'd have to price carbon, suppose a carbon tax, to actually do the good thing, to act responsibly. My impression is, but I hope you'll tell me that I'm wrong, my impression is that equally highly esteemed economic camps differ by about an order of magnitude in how much you'd have to price carbon. So ranging from a low level where what's the big deal, to something that might actually impact conventional economic systems. So if you're a public policymaker, what are you supposed to do?
Well, you have to start somewhere. I mean, Brookings just came out with a study. They were saying starting at $16 a ton, which is pretty low, and then increasing it from there. The issue with pricing is interesting because there are two effects of any time you put a price on something or a tax on something. You change demand and you change supply. What's interesting about the demand equation needs a much higher price. Obviously, for us not to have come here today, the price of gasoline, in effect, a carbon tax on gasoline, maybe not the best way to do it, but it's in effect a gasoline tax is kind of a carbon tax, would have to be very high to have us change our behavior, right? That it would have to be, I don't even know. Everyone would have a different price in this room. It wouldn't even be one price. But we could all, you know, answer that question and come up. And I think folks at UVA actually do this, experiments like this, you know, what price would change your behavior. What's interesting about this whole field is the marginal cost between oils, those that might, or between gas and coal, is not that great. So on the margin on the supply side, you don't need big prices in order to shift investments. So a small price in the near term will go a really long way, especially if it's put it's attached at the very beginning of the process, not at the end point on consumers, but on producers. Someone said it earlier, but up at the front before you accept different things into your, say, pipeline or into your plant. That price doesn't have to be very high for me to say, you know what? wind might be cheaper than gas right now, or gas is cheaper than coal, or this oil that has a smaller carbon footprint is actually now more economic than that oil that has a much larger carbon footprint. So I think that that's definitely the winner way to go, is small prices, very close to producers early on, not focused on the demand side first. The prices have to be too high, and it has to come, the demand side shift is going to have to come when we've truly transformed our taxation policy to relieve taxes on things that we want more of, so that people will accept much higher taxes. It will change their behavior, but it will accept much higher taxes because economically overall they won't be worse off.
Thank you. If cost of production is like $80 to $85 a barrel now, is there no way that oil is going below that?
It's not. Cost of production is all over the board. Cost of production is not only different between different types of oils, the same oils. Like, for example, the oil sands up in Canada that are mined out have a $40 to $60 a barrel marginal price, but the oil that's the SAGD, that steam-assisted gravity drainage, when you have to melt it out of the ground, that has more of an $80 to $90. So there's a real range of prices of oils. And some of the oils, I think it's Iraqi oil, it's in like the cents on the margin. There's some pretty cheap left, you know, remaining oil, just because the stuff flows and it's tapped and it takes like nothing to get it out of the ground except for the geopolitical external cost. It doesn't, you know, it's of its own private cost. So there's a big range in prices, which is why with the last question, which is why on the margin, if you put a price on it and you can work within, you have to hope that the more difficult to produce oils will be the ones that have the higher carbon, because otherwise the pricing can get a little skewed. That has to be worked out, or you need regulation and pricing so that you bring those things into equilibrium more.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.